With four 60-foot-high busts of American presidents right in the middle of America's heartland, Mount Rushmore has become a definitive icon of America. In fact, some call it a shrine of democracy. So beloved is this monument that since 9/11, a plan has been underway to create a 3D model of it should it ever be destroyed or attacked. Interestingly enough, the facts surrounding the creation of Mount Rushmore are as complex as a 3D rendition of the stone sculpture itself. Consider the connection between the Ku Klux Klan and Mount Rushmore sculptor. Also consider the connection between the site of Mount Rushmore and the native Lakota tribe who inhabited the area. The legacy of this American icon is as complex as the legacy of America itself. And joining us to tell us more about Mount Rushmore is Jesse Larner. He is author of the book Mount Rushmore, An Icon Reconsidered. Jesse Larner, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you arrive at the idea of writing a book about Mount Rushmore that would dispel some of the myths about it?
Well, I'd always thought Mount Rushmore was a very odd thing, and I'd always been struck by how I'd seen images of it all over the world, this sort of instantly recognizable icon of American democracy. But I really began thinking of it a few years ago when I was having a conversation with a friend of mine from Slovakia. And I think it's always very interesting to talk about the icons of one's own culture with one who doesn't share that culture. And her frame of reference for monumental sculpture was, of course, Stalinist socialist realism. Now, I don't think the analogy is quite exact, but it does have some Rushmore does have some interesting things in common, I think, with socialist realist sculpture. I think that monumental sculpture has as its purpose the idea of sealing up history, of stopping discussion, of saying that there is this one history that we all can and, in fact, must be a part of. There are some problems with this in terms of Rushmore, and you just mentioned some of them.
Well, tell me a little bit more, because now you have gotten me caught up on socialist realist sculpture. What is that?
Well, I'm sure you know the style of sculpture, the officially accepted style of sculpture of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm,
that was meant
Lenin
to dramatize,
okay,
you know, these very strong figures of the strength of working class peasants, soldiers. It was the way that the regime wanted to be viewed.
And so the whole notion of that is that the sculpture, in a way, bottles up history in
exactly
such a way as to make
it. It stops. I think official sculptures of these type are designed to stop interpretation of history, which doesn't mean that interpretation actually stops. But I think that is the ambition of it. And it's not to say that Rushmore, in fact, does not represent, in the minds of many people, freedom and democracy and the best of the American tradition. But it represents other things, too, and I think those things are important.
Well, tell us about the sculptor, Gutzon Borglum. He is one of the reasons he was considered for the job was his prior experience working on a Confederate monument in Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Yes, that's a very interesting story. Most people who write about Mount Rushmore tend to focus on Gutzon Borglum for very obvious reasons, because he was a very flamboyant, remarkable, romantic character, incredibly energetic, involved in most of the political issues of his day, a very prolific sculptor, contributed more sculptures to the National Gallery in the Capitol than any other American sculptor.
But he seemed to kind of have an ideological shift when he was invited to Stone Mountain.
I'm not sure how much of a shift it was. His very prolific writings, especially those not intended for publication, from very early on, definitely showed a very strong romantic preoccupation with the racial destiny of what he called the Anglo-Saxon races, the people of Northern Europe. And that was very much part of his idea of Mount Rushmore, his vision of manifest destiny as the great sweep of Northern European culture and civilization into the New World, bringing with it freedom and democracy and civilization. What, of course, that doesn't think about is the fact that, especially Mount Rushmore being where it is, that these lands came into the territory of the United States through conquest and colonization in the most undemocratic way, and that the people who were living there before were quite happy with the way that they were living and considerably less so with the new way of life that was imposed on them. As to Stone Mountain, the whole story behind that, Gutzon Borglum became involved with the project Stone Mountain, which was begun by the United Daughters of the Confederacy,
mm-hmm,
as a monument to the Confederate actors in the Civil War.
But it soon attracted the attention and support of the Ku Klux Klan, didn't it?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, the modern Klan really began at Stone Mountain. The Ku Klux Klan has had four or five distinct phases in its history. And really the third phase of the Ku Klux Klan began on Thanksgiving night of 1915 at Stone Mountain. And one of the people who took part in that was actually the owner of Stone Mountain, the person who had donated the site for the sculpture. I think Gutzon Borglum became officially involved with the Klan partly because it furthered his career as the sculptor at Mount Rushmore, also because he was interested in the Klan as a vehicle for his political ambitions. The Klan really reached the peak of its influence in American politics and the peak of its membership in 1923 for a number of reasons that are rather complicated.
Well, what people might say, well, what does his whole ideological orientation have to do with Mount Rushmore? Mount Rushmore, it's my understanding, was originally conceived as a way to boost tourism in South Dakota. When Borglum became involved, that objective seemed to shift.
Yes. Mount Rushmore was first conceived by the South Dakota state historian, Don Robinson, during a speech that he gave in 1923. And his idea really was explicitly just as a tourist attraction to bring money into the state. He originally saw it as really a regional, local monument with pictures from Western history, Red Cloud, Custer, Lewis and Clark. And when Borglum was brought into the project, he was always very preoccupied with national destiny and with his role as an interpreter of national destiny. And he insisted that it had to be national. It couldn't be a South Dakota monument. It had to be a national one. He, in fact, was for a short period simultaneously working on Stone Mountain, which he saw as the southern memorial, and on Mount Rushmore, which he saw as the northern memorial. And he wanted to do both. He was a very contradictory guy, a guy who I think had what could only be termed a racist ideology nowadays, and who was involved in the Ku Klux Klan, but whose greatest personal hero was also Abraham Lincoln, which, by the way, did not thrill the organizers of Stone Mountain at all.
How was the specific area for the Mount Rushmore project picked? Many people may not know that the Black Hills area was considered special to the Lakota tribe who lived in that region. The area itself had a complex history, broken treaties and the like. Talk about that.
Well, as I said, that one of the ironies of Mount Rushmore is the way that it came to be part of the United States. It was the traditional emergency hunting grounds of the Lakota and a center of their spiritual life. It's important to point out that the Lakota also were conquerors of the region, that they were coming west from their traditional area in Minnesota. They had driven out the Crow and the Kiowa about the beginning of the 18th century. They were being driven west by the guns of their enemies, the Chippewa, who had acquired weapons from French traders. They built this very powerful Plains Empire in the early 19th century.
And somebody saw gold in the Black Hills. Huh?
Yes, well, the somebody was Custer, who enters this story several times. He led an expedition through... I should back up a bit and say that there was a treaty negotiated with the Lakota and the Arapaho in 1868 that was one of the very few Indian treaties negotiated from a position of Indian strength in American history, and they got a pretty good deal. They got all of South Dakota west of the Missouri and big chunks of Nebraska and Wyoming and Montana, and some of it as part of an official reservation and some of it as part of what was called unceded hunting territory. But there had long been rumors of gold in the Black Hills. And when Custer, and there was a national depression going on, the biggest depression that the country was to know until the 1930s, from the panic of 1873. This gold in the Black Hills, which was fairly confidently known to be there, was an attractive target to many people who were out of work. But by the terms of the treaty, white folks weren't supposed to enter the Great Sioux Reservation, and the army was obligated to keep them out. Custer's expedition was sort of an illegal gray area because he was allowed to go there on a purely reconnaissance mission. He wasn't supposed to be prospecting, but of course everyone knew that he was. And of course, as soon as he found gold, the army basically was not very inclined to keep out these enormous numbers of people seeking their fortunes in the Black Hills, and the treaty was soon unilaterally negotiated in 1877.
You know, Jesse Larnauer, and you're in the business of debunking myths. Sometimes it takes a little time, and we don't have enough time today. This is a story that needs to be continued because the U.S. government and the Lakota tribe waged what may be considered the longest lawsuit in history, and it was in 1980 that the lawsuit was finalized. We don't have time to give details here, but would you make a promise to come back and continue this discussion?
I'd be delighted to.
We'll be delighted to have you back. The book is called Mount Rushmore, an Icon Reconsidered. The next time we'll take telephone calls during the course of this discussion so you can give your opinion on Jesse Larnauer's research and what he has talked about. I'm Kojo Namdi. Wednesday.